This is the Limitless, the podcast between. You are now listening to a conversation I had with Tim Kay, who reached out to me with some questions. So that's pretty much as formal as I get. We have begun. Once I hit record, I'm hoping that you're going to, not that you, I don't want you to interview me or anything, but I'm hoping that you'll kind of get the ball rolling, because I've been just catching up on things right until this last minute. So I know generally what we're here to talk about, but not so clear on the specifics. I know it's Christianity and writing. Those are the two main topics. So where should we begin?
Well, I wanted to start with writing. So just a little bit about me and why I decided I wanted to talk with you is that I've been following you for about 5 or 6 years, just slightly before you started The Liminalist. And I've also gone through your back catalog from when you were on Doug Lane's Diet Soap from years ago and all of that, and just reading your blog. And I just wondered what sprung to mind, because I've been really getting into lately narrative, studying all things about narrative and how one crafts it. What is the purpose of narrative? How does it unfold? How does it flow, and so on? And I just wanted to pick your brain, so to speak, of what prompted you to, or rather, what's a better question? Did you think that putting forth your ideas, and I've read just part of your books, that again, your blog mostly, is did you think that writing was better than speaking or doing interviews like you've done in The Liminalist, or do you think that writing has fallen short of the mark? And your writing process, and I don't know, just the entire process you go through.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. They're definitely quite different. I mean, they obviously get conflated together for obvious reasons. I mean, obviously, if somebody does both, then they do. But even we think of them in the same ballpark, speaking and writing, because it's using language. I think they may be more dissimilar than they're alike. I don't know. I mean, so we could get into the whole meta question there, and maybe we will. But I mean, the obvious difference is one is using one's physical voice, which is to say one's body, one's whole body really, to speak. I mean, I don't want to get trapped in the semantics right away, but there is something fundamentally different between using one's physical voice and then just using one's fingers to write, clearly. And the other obvious difference is that speaking is, unless you're like my brother, and I don't know if you followed him or any awareness about my brother, but he used to have these sticky notes all around his desk with little bon mots, as they say in French, pleasantries, little witticisms and comebacks, and he would learn them by heart. And probably he rehearsed them. I never asked him about that part. But it was clear, talking to him, even as his brother, that some of the time he was kind of waiting for an opportunity to use these pre-composed lines, and it was very contrived, and it made it very difficult to have a conversation with him some of the time. And I suppose to some extent we do that, we pre-script our thoughts, but it's certainly a lot harder to speak in a way that's pre-composed. So there's an opportunity for discovering things that I find by speaking, that it's not that it isn't there in writing, but it's much more central with speaking. And the other thing about speaking, although I do sometimes do solo podcasts, I do them less now, Mostly they're dialogues. So a dialogue is just that. It's a series of responses to somebody else, you know, mutual responses. And that's clearly very different than a monologue. Or, generally speaking, writing, where one is just starting and ending with one's own headspace. What they have in common is working things out, potentially anyway. Like I would say I've become more and more conscious of writing to work things out and to make things conscious. So that, I think that that's the thing that they have in common, which I would also say is maybe the thing that makes them of value, is that I can become conscious of things that I wouldn't otherwise become conscious of by speaking and by writing. I don't know if it started that way, however. I mean, I'll just make one last observation before I'll hand it back to you, and that's that I pretty much started speaking, recording my voice before I started writing, although I didn't continue it right away as a kid, but I did make a few audio tapes as a kid of Winnie the Pooh. I've still got some of them, because my stepfather used to read to me Winnie the Pooh, and he would record it so I could listen to the tapes. So one day I said, oh, I could do this, and I took off the tape recorder and I did it. It was a bit of an anecdote that my mother used to tell because of how decisive I was about that at such a young age, and how clearly committed I was once I realized that this technology existed to using it. And I was also interviewed on the radio around that time. We're talking around 6, 7 or 8 years old. So there is something for me that about using my voice that goes back quite early on, even though, as I say, I didn't continue it at first, and I started writing, you know, as a sort of career thing, before I started speaking. So from my teenage years through my 20s, I was writing and then publishing, and then I only got into podcasting about 12 years ago. So it's as though that took me a while to rediscover that. But I would say that overall, I think speaking is closer to a wholesome or a holistic activity than writing. And I've still got some ambivalence about writing, how effective it is and what it's effective and why I do it, which I guess is kind of the nub of your question. Is that right?
Yeah, that ties into it. I wanted to go back to what you said about your brother. I've heard you talk about your brother before. I don't really know him that well. I understand he was an artist, and I've seen some clips of him online. But I wonder why he felt the need to use those sticky notes. Was he on the defensive, or was he really trying to – he looked at a conversation as a fencing match, and he just wanted to get his hits in.
Yeah. Well, that would be defensive, wouldn't it?
Yeah, the best offense, the best defense is the best offense, or something like that.
Yeah, and he was a Leo, not to get astrological, but that's performance. That's all about performance, and that was certainly true of him. He saw life as a performance, and he saw conversation as a performance, as an opportunity to shine. So you could say that that's quite a childlike thing. Look at me, look at me. Isn't necessarily defensive, but
was he trying to take a page from Oscar Wilde or something?
He certainly liked and read Oscar Wilde. He denied that Oscar Wilde was a true dandy, and that was my brother's philosophy, was the dandy philosophy, which I found out after he died that dandies started as human billboards, that it was fabric companies that hired men to walk around with these fabrics and advertise the clothing, so they were like human billboards, and anyway, that's something. I don't know if my brother ever knew that, but he saw dandyism as a philosophy that about externalization and about it'd be difficult for me to even sum it up except a kind of new age thing of you create your own reality and you create who you are as your own invention, although he wasn't new age at all. I don't know if that's Oscar Wildean or not, but he was certainly influenced by Wilde and by a number of other key influences who he used as role models to create this identity out of. It's the same thing that I try and deconstruct with seen and not seen, which, bringing it back to me, is the for me, that feels like the first book that I wrote that was really in line with what I see as the purpose of writing, at least for now, and that is deconstructing or deconditioning myself. So I was observing, I began to observe the way I'd done what my brother had done in a less obvious way, although still pretty obvious, as in I'd taken cues from the culture and I'd used them to build an identity out of. So the sticky notes are almost like a literalization of that, because especially seeing some of those lines weren't even his own. He would read a quote and think, I want to use that, and so then he would write that on the sticky note. He would never attribute them, he would just steal them and make them his own.
Yeah, what popped into mind just now, tying into one of your earlier questions, is the word I'm looking for, the mechanical aspect of speaking, such as, you know, as we grow up and we learn to speak, we're, you know, to use your tool of mimesis there, and I've read a little bit of Girard, so I know where you were coming from there, is it's mimetic. You're copying what the accents are, you kind of take them on, and then whatever the speech patterns are of your immediate family and then your peers and then the wider culture. And I know that way back when I was in my late teens trying to write, I didn't write that much, so I was unpracticed. And I kept, when I got into it, I was using lots of things that I was taking from reading. Of course, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, where they say some of the best writers, they read a lot. So You're already imbibing in some of that language and the way that you're going to express yourself. And then maybe over time, you start to come into your own voice. So it seems like what you had said with seeing and not seeing is that you were deconstructing yourself, and then in the process you were trying to find your own voice through language.
Yeah. I mean, those things just unfolded parallel. It was very symmetrical, because I did find my voice by writing about how I'd lost my voice or how I'd been colonized or how I'd had allowed myself to be possessed by other people's voices, starting with my brother. It actually started, I mean, what I see as my maturation as a writer, quote, I have put that word in quotes, started with me realizing that I'd internalized my brother's voice, particularly around writing. When I'd write stuff, I would hear him criticizing it and even scorning it, because I read about things he did scorn, such as conspiracies and aliens and UFOs and things like that. So, but at a certain point, I realized, my God, I've got his voice in my head. And that was when I wrote Paper Tiger, and that, with, looking back, that was sort of, that was the beginning of a new trajectory as a writer, where it became much more psychotherapeutic for me to write. I mean, not just, there's, I want to use a different word there, but anyway, we'll leave that as a gap. It became something else, something much more intimate and embodied, I feel. Like what I felt that I was groping my way towards was seen and not seen. And this is, again, about finding the voice in almost a literal way, was I was learning to write with all of my body rather than just with my mind and my fingers.
When you say writing with your body, did you write seen and not seen on the keyboard or longhand?
I almost always write books longhand first, although not exclusively, of course, because editing has rewriting and new bits added. But in terms of if I got, I say if, because sometimes books are, I'm sort of recycling old material, but if I need new material to write a book, well, if I'm starting with the new material, then I almost always start with a pen and a notebook, preferably outside or in bed or somewhere where I can be very, very physically comfortable.
Do you think that works better than typing?
Well, it absolutely, otherwise I wouldn't do it. And the reason is, I mean, I don't like to read on computers either. Obviously, I read emails and websites, but I mean, if I'm going to read a book, I won't read it on the computer. I'll either read it physically as a book or I won't read it, because the way that I am in my body at a computer is very different than when I'm walking or lying in the sun or lying in bed, where I'm much more able to have an experience of my body in its physical environment, as opposed to when you're on a computer, it disembodies, doesn't it? Because our attention is on the screen and our body is really just holding up our head so that we can look at the screen.
Yeah, for sure. Well, then my next question for writing is, you say that you were learning to write with your entire body over time. Then, now I guess a related question is, because I've been following you for some time, is there was something about your content that really attracted me, not so much in the UFOs and all of that stuff. I've had a passing interest in that over the years. You know, I never really immersed myself into it and then had to extricate myself from it. Mm. I started with philosophy a long time ago, like in 1920 or so, and I've kept up the reading since. So I've always kind of had a sharpened antenna to anything that I found interesting or intriguing, even if it was not mainstream. Certainly if it was not mainstream, something that was a little bit more esoteric. And I also have to say that I never really got into the occult that much too. It kind of was a passing thing. I mean, I played around with tarot cards when I was in high school, but that lasted for about a month or so. And never really read Blavatsky or Crowley or any of those people. I never was attracted to that much. It was strictly your standard Hume, Kant, Hegel, analytic philosophy and things like that. Although, you know, what you mentioned about Bertrand Russell was interesting too with the Fabians. So, but that attracted me, those kind of things. Mm-hmm. And if you were finding what your own voice was by deconstructing yourself, then how do you think it you're able to attract people with your writing and your speaking, if that makes sense?
Well, I think one of the there's a certain kind of attraction that my work has, that therefore it attracts a certain kind of person, and that is a person who is wrestling with, well, I mean, certainly existential questions, which presumably you were an interest in philosophy suggests that some basic fundamental but perhaps abstract concerns about the nature of reality and of the self. But I would say that, I mean, that's a very wide spectrum and that can be very academic, whereas I think that I tend to attract individuals for whom it's much more a matter of life and death, that they get free of something, which is this crushing, oppressive, relentless feeling of unreality and inauthenticity and the suffering that goes along with it. So the Matrix was a very handy model there, the splinter in the mind thing, something that just never gives us any peace. Well, so I'd say that, I mean, I'm not sure how you meant your question, but one of the ways I understood it was, how do I manage to attract people if I'm writing, trying to find my voice by writing, because that would make what I do very rough and unformed and maybe chaotic, or I'm not sure how you meant it, but I accept all of those possibilities. And I think that people are drawn to that. It also makes it more transparent. It potentially makes it self-invalidating or, you know, self-neutralizing. There's always that risk. But interesting, I mean, the last blog post, I just put it up right before we spoke. It was one of the reasons why I said I didn't have time to do any preparing. It was about the Dave O'Shaughnessy event on Sunday, and that's all about how enlightenment comes down to constantly doubting oneself, or at least the path to that state of wholeness or authenticity is a path of relentless self-doubt. And so, yeah, I would say that there's something, what can I say? It's not, I don't want to say reassuring, but there's something, or even comforting necessarily, or they do say you should comfort the disturbed, don't they, and disturb the comfortable, and I think I try to do both. But it's more than just comforting. There's something orienting for, I think, that people who are drawn to me, they find, okay, here's somebody who's seeking and who has found certain things but is still seeking and is very, tries to be honest about what I don't know. So there's a kind of a bit of a conundrum there that could become a dog chasing its tail, but the finding one's authentic voice or one's true voice begins with admitting that one hasn't found it and that one isn't using it, right? That this, you know, it's kind of like the Cretan thing, the Cretan who says all Cretans are lies. It's a little bit like that. But, you know, there's something about showing that. It's vulnerability, but it's also, it's meta. It's showing the inner workings. And then there's, again, with seen and not seen, I mean, a different way that I understood or realized that writing with my full body could be described was that I was writing about the act of writing the book in the very moment I was writing it. So then the reader would have that, potentially would have that experience as I had while writing it, of this is right now in this moment. They're reading a sentence that's saying, I don't know why this sentence is being written, or this sentence is coming. You know, I'd have to give you an example from the book, otherwise it would just seem a bit blah. But there's something that I would have those momentary, not necessarily epiphanies, but just a moment of stark reality of here I am, I'm writing, I'm trying to finish this sentence, and this is how it began, and I don't yet know how it's going to end. But that's why I'm writing it, and somehow that includes the reader too. Right? We're in that mutual experience of existential uncertainty. I ended up quite poetic and abstract, so hopefully you can do something with it. I don't, you know. Hopefully it made sense. But again, I mean, the voice. What is a true voice? It seems to me it's spontaneous, and it's coming through the body, perhaps from the soul. We might end up getting religious very quickly if we go there, but not from the mind. Actually, not from the mind. The mind has this function of clothing it in language, but the actual impulse to articulate is coming from somewhere else.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about truth. In your writing, are you trying to get at a truth, or do you just follow it where it takes you? Because having read for so long and done the writing myself, is I don't feel that I'm necessarily conveying any kind of truth, or if it's a subjective truth of what my own experience is. Giving a description and saying, you know, I could, going back to what you said about your brother, is that it's a bon mot witticism. You throw it out there and some people will get it instantly because they've heard it before and they possibly know the meaning of it. And then other times they're disarmed because it's a thought pattern interrupter, so they don't quite know what to respond to that. So reading your stuff, like all the talk that you had about Whitley Strieber, I went through some of your old series there, and I remember Strieber's book when it was on the bookshelves a long time ago. Never read it because I'm just like, oh, that's interesting, and it just passed me by. Yeah. But then you really drilling deep down into Strieber to find out, because he took it as true, so one of his experiences. Now, whether it's true or not, I guess that's still an open question for people. But I'm just curious about do you have an urge to tell the truth, and do you believe this is the truth, or whatever the truth might be, if that makes sense?
Right, it's levels, isn't it? Because if somebody asks you, you know, did you take my shovel? My shovel's gone missing. There's a true and an untrue answer to that, whether you took it or not, right? Yes or no, and one is true and one is false. So there's plenty of ways in which we have a choice whether to tell the truth or lie, right? And that would extend to writing, like right with Strieber and his accounts, even if he doesn't know, let's say. He doesn't have to be lying, but he might be saying he knows when he doesn't know, and he's lying to himself and or a little bit, you know, whatever, his poetic license. We do that all the time. Ms. Strieber is an amazing case study in that regard, because he's talking about experiences that, if true, they either transcend what we know about reality, or they're not what he thinks they are, i.e. they're some kind of human thing that doesn't transcend anything, it's just very well concealed. And that's what I try to get to with Vice of Kings, as well as Prisoner Infinity, in a different way. Vice of Kings is more about me. More directly, that there are things in my past that I don't know if they're true or not, but I do believe it's possible to get to the truth whether I ever will or not. And so that's one level, but I think you're asking about a much higher, deeper level, aren't you? I mean, you're talking about whether the truth can be in any way encapsulated with language. Would that be accurate?
I mean, that's part of it. What you said about, and you've talked about this before in your episodes, of you don't know if what happened in your past is true or not. You have maybe a will to believe that they were true, but there's no way for sure that you can corroborate that, because you can't go back in time, and the people that were involved are probably no longer with us.
Yeah, and so that leaves me with a number of things, one of which you just named there, which is I seem to have a desire to believe they're true, and so that's a huge question mark. Why would anybody want something like that to be true? And so I kind of stay with that, just as with Strieber. I mean, I try and stay with what we can see or what we can confirm, because the actual reality of the events being described or hypothesized, in my case, they can't be fully confirmed. But what we can work with is the psychology and the perceptions and the feelings and whatnot in the present. And this was also with my brother. I mean, when my brother died, and it was leading up before he died as well, I was starting to realize that his whole dandy act was some sort of cry for help. A desperate cry of a drowning man, and then he drowned, and so then I knew that I was right about that. He had been drowning and he had been crying out. And so what happened to him? Because one thing, if somebody's wounded and they're crying out, that's relatively straightforward. But when somebody's so wounded, or wounded in such a way that their cry for help is disguised as a performance art that make people celebrate and admire them and want to make movies out of their best-selling books, Strieber is a parallel example there. You've got to ask, or I do, because it was my brother, what's the true nature of the wound? What's the true configuration of the driving forces behind that identity and that writing? And that's why I came up with the term crucial fiction, which, of course, is there's a lot in that term, because, of course, it sounds like crucifixion, which not only corresponds with my brother, but corresponds with trauma and the destruction of the identity and these things. But the obvious meaning that I was using was a fiction that is crucial to us, that without it, our world collapses and our identity collapses and we simply cannot cope with reality. And that's what I feel Strieber was doing. That's why how I hit upon that term, and what my brother was doing. But we all do it. We all do it. And a language is one of the main tools by which we create the fiction, right? I mean, literary is, of course, fiction is language based, and our thinking. You know, the narratives we tell ourselves about reality are very much sourced in our thinking, and that is also language. So they're buffers from feelings, and I would say the feelings are closer to the truth. But then what's behind the feelings, and let's say, just to keep it concise, that's trauma, then that's closer still to the truth. And maybe that's as far as we need to get, because there's a tendency. There's at least two ways we can go for there. One is, what happened? Can I understand the nature of the trauma? And I don't really think that works, although I think it's a valid pursuit for reasons that maybe I'll get into if you want. But I do think it can work, but not in the sense of finding out what happened and then resolving it by finding out, but just keeping your attention on something. But the other way to go, and it's not either or, is, what am I underneath the trauma? What's the shape of my soul and my nervous system, if I imagine it, or I start to intuit it without the imprinting of the trauma or the affect, then we'd be getting to the truth. And that, again, would be a truth of the body, I think, like it's a bodily truth. So we got that terrible conundrum, really, is if we're using language to try and get to the truth, and we're discovering that language is the thing that has imprinted us and taken us out of our bodily sense of what's true, then we end up seeing that the tool we're using is kind of like trying to dig one's way to Australia. It's never going to actually get us where we're going.
strong now. I don't belong now in this world anymore. I'll say a final prayer for those I care for who kept my company. My destiny is clear, and I'm to have you near to me. Lord, I don't belong now. If you are waiting, I'm afraid to die. I've been
the term I remember from critical theory is the prison house of language. Yeah, it's, I guess what attracted me to your stuff is the one I thought it was kind of esoteric. And again, that goes back to when I first started to get into philosophy, because I found it as esoteric. It's secret knowledge, even though really, you know, lots of different books that you can pull out on Aristotle, and it's not secret necessarily. Secret, and maybe in the sense is that the vast majority don't care about it and they're not going to read about it.
Yeah.
Much less they're going to read something about the occult, you know. Well, I probably could also make the argument is that there's more people who seem interested in the occult than they would in reading Aristotle or Plato, because it is a secret knowledge. But then what in our discussion here about language, it's because if I picked up the Satanic Bible, and you know that was a big thing back in the 80s, and you read it and you're just like, how can anybody possibly believe this? Is this fiction? Hmm. But some people really take it seriously. And it's just a book. It's with language. But what is it about the book or the contents of the book and even the language itself that resonates or attracts some people and it, for others it doesn't?
Yeah.
Just like reading novels or things like that. And you know, what you'd ask if I'd asked myself that question, or 16 or 17, I couldn't come up with an answer. But now, many, many years later, having studied a lot, read a lot in many different things, it's I could take your experiences, but possibly it's a trauma that attracts the person to that. And then they might really go deep down the rabbit hole into the occult where they're practicing it and not just LARPing or reading it as an academic subject. And then that language over time imprints upon the person as they're reading through it, and then they take on a certain kind of form. But again, what is it that attracted them there in the first place? It certainly wasn't the language, possibly.
Well, I think it would be, I suppose we could say the transmission, if we wanted to do shorthand, as in what LaVey in this case, or Strieber or Crowley, for me, I was never drawn to Satanism, but I was drawn to occultism and to the UFO narrative that Strieber presented. What those books were transmitting through the words, like the words were carriers, but at the same time the words were kind of pacifiers. So if you imagine this, back to my brother again, the cry for help, if you imagine that somebody is using writing and creativity and the construction of narratives, including esoteric ones, as a way to manage their trauma, And they're doing it so well that they themselves don't even know that that's what they're doing. Like, they've managed their trauma so well that they've just created this creative altar that just spins narratives and enjoys spinning narratives. And although the narratives have traumatic elements in them, they're not dealing directly with that person's trauma. They're crucial fictions that, in Strieber's case, Crowley's case, and my brother's, in all these cases, they turn the traumata into a tale of empowerment. Then, and LaVey as well, I don't really know about his background, but obviously Satanic Bible's all about self-empowerment, Satanism is generally. There's something in that it's like it gives us something to imitate that we believe will work or that will work at a certain level. It allows us to do the same. It allows us to turn the traumatic affect and all that discomfort and distress and all the horrible feelings we don't want to feel into narratives that we can then tell ourselves and reify and reinforce by LARPing, as you put it. The more we believe them, the more we propagate them, maybe we write our own books that extend on them, then we're actually taking on the same training. It's almost like military training in a much more subtle, esoteric way that will turn us into super soldiers who never have to experience our own pain or get wounded again. So I think that that's the answer. Like, something in us is unsettled, is uncomfortable, is painful, and so we're looking for ways not to feel it. And then we see this or that book or title or, you know, image on the cover, whatever it is that first captures us, and we go, that looks interesting. And then we start digging in and we start resonating, and we think that we're resonating with the story. But that's relatively superficial. What we're actually resonating with is the transmission, which is that the person's own distress, that distress signal. But because it's disguised, we're not just thinking that person needs help, maybe I should help them. We're thinking that person has found the answer.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. For sure. I wanted to back up a minute and go back to something you said earlier about the writing. I don't quite remember what you said, but it reminds me of Richard Rorty, the one American philosopher who was active in the 20th century, and he was part of the what was called the neo-pragmatist movement. And in one of his books from the mid-80s, Contingency, Irony, and Solidarity, he talked about sentences versus vocabularies. And okay, what's the difference? Well, a sentence might contain a truth value. You know, my shovel is here or it's not, true or false, by referring to correspondence. But if it's a vocabulary, that's the totality of whatever the language is. It could be one's native language and smatterings of any other languages you might speak, or a hybrid of all those things. And so Rorty's point was that, and he was very critical of analytic philosophy at the end of the 20th century at the time, where let's not concern ourselves like the analytic philosophers do about what's true or what's false and getting the perfect language to accurately reflect what reality is. Rather, language is a tool that we use to shape our reality. You could even say tell ourselves stories, communication, such things. And then a further point is he talked about the ironist, which is someone who is aware that the vocabulary they have is, number one, contingent, that, you know, somebody was born into an Anglo society and so they grew up speaking English as a native language. And they know that that was contingent. They could have been born in France, Germany, or Indonesia, or somewhere else. They take that and then they take whatever the whatever the ideas are conveyed in that language at the time, maybe also as a contingency. And if the person is able to function with that language, but at the same time understanding that it is contingent, that it could be something else, that, you know, we live in the early 21st century, whereas in the 18th century, they spoke differently about things, understanding that. And if the person can balance that as a liberal ironist, because he was sort of a classical liberal in that respect. That's better than really trying to be obsessed with the truth and really getting to what's true or false. And so when we're talking about like the occult literature, it definitely is the case if the person is trying to take on the language and whatever the message being conveyed in that language is to mask or mollify the trauma, they're certainly not going to be an ironist about it. And if you ever point that out to them, they will completely break down. That's been your experience, I'm sure.
I would say yes, tentatively, although I think that was quite abstract what you described there, particularly because I'm not familiar with ironism, if that's the word for it. But I mean, what occurs to me is that it's a postmodern thing within the postmodern mindset, which is quite consistent with the occult / New Age mindset in many ways. Irony is very front and center, actually. So like Crowley was an ironist in some ways, I would say. Strieber certainly isn't. He's very, very earnest. My brother was totally an ironist. I shouldn't say that because I say I don't know that word, but my brother used irony all the time, and everything was ironic. Like that was part of his sticky note identity complex. Like he everything had to be leavened with irony, I think.
That was part of his performance.
Yes. I think that an awareness that language is compromised can itself be, I want to say satanic, actually, because that word's pushing itself forward, but obviously that's shorthand, but it can be nihilistic, right? That it can lead to a sort of abandonment of integrity, which says, well, language defines our reality and language is compromised. So like my brother believed, he used to say rather that impure and pure motives are always mixed up. So that was very central to his philosophy, that there was no purity, there was no such thing as purity, which is, you know, ontologically indefensible, if you like. Like you can't have the concept of impurity without positing a potentially pure state. So that's a kind of sophistry, I would say, but I'm kind of connecting that to irony there. Perhaps I'm not sure rightly or wrongly, but maybe I should stop talking now, because as I said, I don't really quite know what ironism is, but that was my first sense, was that I'm not quite sure, I'm not quite convinced that what you described there would necessarily be the lesser of two evils.
Well, how about shifting a minute to go into inversion? Because I've heard that term bandied about with you, with Jay Dyer, Vox Day, and people like that, where they're definitely focusing more and more on an inversion. And I never really understood inversion until after I started listening to you guys and reading a little bit more in the occult. I think I understand what it is. So you're using words in the way that they were not really intended, but redeploying what I had just said about the contingency of language, then, or the ironic approach to things. I don't know. Did you, in your brother's case, did you think that, understandably so, he was ironic and that was part of his performance, that he was subconsciously inverting things, quite possibly?
Yeah, I think that that's fair to say. I mean, he had an oppositional identity, as do I, or have, you know, become aware of myself, and that has a tendency, you know, when we're in opposition to social norms and reality, that would lead to a tendency to invert things, as in, you know, evil be thou my good kind of thing is the extreme thing, and I mean, I'd like to bring actually something up that you mentioned a bit earlier in relation to this, which is about how language can be used to disrupt people's ordinary thinking or habitual thinking patterns, because that can be one use of, I suppose, irony, but certainly inversion. Like if we use a word, or if we present a perspective or an orientation that seems the inverse of what is socially expected of us, that can be quite disorienting. It can cause cognitive dissonance, and I I'm not sure about doing that consciously. Like that's very Crowley-esque. I'm not quite sure how you're using the term inversion here, because there's a number of different ways you can put it. But certainly in terms of using language, and I would say this would have to be intuitive and spontaneous and not something that was systematized, but that language can definitely be used to confound our patterns of thought, starting with our own, I suppose. Although I'd say that probably we have to interrupt our thinking patterns in order to speak in a way that isn't habitual or you know, confined to some sort of matrix script. But then if we do that, the way that we speak will naturally be subversive in a good sense, as in it will interrupt people's thought patterns and they won't quite know how to receive or to respond to what's being said. And I think that there is some potential there for language to then be more consistent with the life force, because it seems that the life force doesn't have a dualistic framework for expression, if you see what I mean. Like hot and cold is a continuum for the life force, and it's not. There is no hot or cold. There's simply sensation. There isn't even temperature for the life force or for the body. There's simply sensation, right? And those are different, you know, hot and cold are different sensations, but they're certainly not a polarity of hot and cold, but nor are they even temperature. They're sensations, right? We've got these layers and layers of languified interpretation that all come down to sensations, and perhaps something even deeper that we don't have a word for. So therefore it stands to reason that we, like our cat or our dog or an infant child, we have the potential still to express much more non-mediated forms of experience that are more sensational, and that those would be inherently disruptive in the way that you were suggesting earlier. I'm not sure how that relates to this question of inverted, but that was what my life force came up with anyway.
Yeah, well, you talked about the life force before, and going back to your earlier point about how you're writing more from the body now than you once was before. So has there been any times when you were writing in longhand and things, when they talk about things just flow? So do you feel that the language that you're writing, whatever it might be, resonates a lot more with whatever your life force is as you're writing in longhand on the page?
Well, I mean, I certainly hope so, but I kind of assume so, because everything else that I've been doing in my experience is more embodied and more in the flow. Not consistently, I have good days and bad days, but consistently in the sense of over the months and the years, there's been that trajectory. But I kind of, your question sort of stopped my thinking a bit. Because I think there's something about when the life force moves us, or as it moves us, the mind actually can't comment on it. You know how our mind has this running commentary, like at the racetracks, you know, describing everything that's happening in rapid fire. But actually, it's always one step behind, obviously, because the time it takes to comment, to provide a commentary, things have changed. So that the mind carries on doing that anyway, but when this more mysterious thing that we call the life force is moving, it's much too quick for our minds to catch it. So sometimes it catches up later and says, oh, my life force was doing that. But I think a lot of the time it doesn't notice at all, and that's why we need others to point it out. I just had this experience talking to my sister, actually. She's described an experience of watching me on this meeting and things that she felt were happening for me. And I don't know if they were or not, actually, but I certainly leave it open. It's quite possible that I was undergoing, or that I am often undergoing, profound experiences, and the nature, or one of the features of their profundity is that my mind isn't actually, you know, invited to the party to spoil it. So So with writing, I wouldn't necessarily correlate being in the life force or writing with my body with a flow thing, because, I mean, with that kind of flow, because, I mean, throughout my life I've had periods of inspiration where I'm, you know, it's coming faster than I can write. My right handwriting is illegible because of this, because always, not always, but generally when I'm writing, it comes far too fast for me to be able to write it down. So the flow is, in that sense, is quite a familiar thing for me, even when I was in my mind. So this has to be something subtler, and I'm guessing it has more to do with, and it wouldn't be laborious, but with, and this will make it sound laborious, but choosing words much more carefully, which almost sounds like the opposite of free flow, but it isn't. It's just that, I mean, this is what I hope anyway, is that I could become more economical with language, and therefore more responsible with it.
How about the difference between writing and speaking? So what just popped into mind is, it's a central tenet of deconstruction going all the way back to Jacques Derrida, where he criticized what he called the logocentrism, which is prioritizing speech over writing. Writing was derivative. And he cited this goes all the way back to Plato and what's called the seventh letter, that writing was, I forget the exact term, ineffective speech. So speaking, like you and I are doing right now, is present. And so we are connected through this conversation. Versus if we had exchanged emails back and forth, those would persist over time, as would recordings, conversations here, but the technology didn't exist back then. But writing was derivative, and writing can be interpreted and misinterpreted all every which way from Sunday over time, depending on who's reading it. Some people, going back to the earlier point, will take to it like a fish to water, because of the message that's conveyed, what they see in, and other people will just pass it by. They have no interest in it. So I'm wondering if you felt that doing the podcast and having conversations like we are now are becoming much more effective than writing the blog or in your books.
Well, I see them as mutually supporting one another. I mean, we wouldn't be talking probably if I hadn't put writing out there that had got your interest. And also we can refer to the things I've written in this conversation. So they support each other, for one thing. They're also part of a continuum, a process that, as I said to begin with, like I'm working on with the writing and with the working, and with the talking. And even when I write, I mean, this is a funny thing with my brother, was realizing his voice was in my head. I realized that whenever I would write, I was he was the imaginary reader. So everything I wrote was, in a weird way, was to him. That was because I was trying to get him out of my head, right, unconsciously. So now that he is out of my head, more or less, I'm still... To some extent, I'm still, this is such a weird, a mysterious thing, but you know, when I write a blog post, it's as though it doesn't fully exist until it's read by somebody else. A bit like I'm thinking of a sperm now, like a sperm until it meets the egg is, what is it really? It's just one of legions of kind of, not necessarily purposeless, but, you know, as yet unfulfilled potentials. So although there is something that happens with my writing just by writing it, I discover things, and that's what makes the piece of writing have value, that I made these discoveries in the act of doing it. I would say largely it's that. It hasn't actually really become fully conceived until somebody reads it. And so then my intuitive sense, even though this is non-rational really, is that the future reader is pulling something out of me. And that, because so I'm unconsciously trying to answer a need in, let's say, you, because I'm talking to you, even though when I was writing some given piece that you read a year or 2 years later, you didn't even know about me, and I didn't know about you, and in fact, I didn't even know about you after you'd read it. It wasn't contingent on any awareness of you as a reader, but there was some instinctive, if that's the right word, I honestly don't know, process going on here. I mean, well, we're getting very mystical, or not very, but we're heading into mystical waters, because this would only make sense to me as if we're already interconnected, and if you and I are already connected at some metaphysical level, if we want to go there, or even some unknown physical level, I suppose it's the same as metaphysical, I was, some part of me was aware of that even when I was writing or podcasting, you know, and you were always there in my field of awareness. So I think when we talk about speaking language, one of the things that makes it seem more pure or more primal or primary is it's much more obviously a response. It's much more obviously a spontaneous response to the presence of the other. And to me, that's closer to what true communication is, or we could even say what truth is when there's a true echo response thing that opens up between two sentient beings. I think truth is somehow born out of that, and with writing it's not so obvious, but that doesn't mean it's not there. And as far as primary or secondary, I've only ever based that on the assumption that people learn to speak before they learn to write, you know? So it just seemed a sequence of things, as far as the purity or the impurity, I think that's more to do with the congruency between the language being used and the sensations that are actually occurring in the individual body that's using the language.
Mm-hmm. Did you have time to talk about evil?
Well, I mean, I've certainly got time. I think I've got a couple of hours today, but because you ended on evil, of course, that's a very big subject. That's why I laughed. But sure, if you want to go, evil.
Yeah, I wanted to riff off what I wanted to start off with language because I thought that was a good operative principle going through. So
yeah.
And I've heard you talk about evil. I've heard Jay Dyer talk about evil and the rest of them. And I sometimes don't know what to think about it, because having read philosophy as I have, some philosophers will explain it away. Others that are more of the Christian persuasion come up with the term as theodicy, which is an explanation of why, if there is an all... if there's an omnibenevolent creator God, why does he allow evil in the world? And we're talking about also base evil, like why why do babies contract a horrible disease and they die? Or why are there stillbirths or things like that? Something that's very low level versus a malevolent entity that exists out there. And it's the latter that I've kind of been on the fence about for many years, never really thought about it too much. And so I'm wondering if the language might not conjure that up, depending on whatever one's religious heritage is. And full disclosure, I come from a Catholic background, so I know it talks about the devil, I know it talks about Satan and all of that, but also I understand that Satan was a different concept from the way the Jews talked about it versus the Christians. Mm-hmm. Satan doesn't exist in certain areas within Christianity, and so on and so forth. So that's why I'm somewhat on the fence, because I've kind of seen all of the arguments, and I know that some people would, particularly in the case of the occult, they would certainly, without question, say that there are evil, malevolent entities out there. Me, I'm not so sure, because I was not immersed in the occult. I just approach it more from a scholar's perspective. So then I wonder about language and describing malevolent entities that they exist, or, you know, bringing in Strieber, talking about otherworldly entities, aliens, and things like that. They're not malevolent necessarily, but somebody would look at that. And then I also think that they would, such people would be more inclined to believe in angels and demons, but they would completely scoff at the idea that there's gray men out there, a la Strieber. So I don't know what your take is on that.
Certainly been mutating, whether evolving or slowly dying, I don't know, over the years. Although I've never been a literal minded person. In some ways I'm very literal minded, so it's complicated, of course, but when it comes to entities, I've never been literal minded. I used to have the view, in fact I even have some song lyrics that I still sing from time to time. Angel or demon, it's all the same to me. Let's crucify Lucifer and set him free. The angelic, what we think of as angelic and demonic entities, are two poles of a single energy in the universe. I mean, so I'm saying what I used to believe. This is when I was esoteric minded. Now I don't know. That seems like a better model than the Manichaean one of good battling evil, which just doesn't add up, just as the Christian idea of an all-loving God who sends people to hell if they don't worship him doesn't add up. And or, as you put, I mean, the thing about why does evil exist if God's omnipotent? Certainly we could say if God's omnipotent, how can Satan be any kind of adversary for God, right? It's like the US versus Afghanistan, right? There's no war going on there. There's just some kind of
twisted symbiotic relationship.
Yeah. So and perception management, of course. I'm just thinking now because it's I mean, the first thing, I suppose, is it, and I think you asked this, is it useful to think about? Is it useful to speculate upon? Is it necessary, even? I think, well, we can definitely say it's not necessary. So then the question is it useful? And, I mean, I've certainly found it interesting to speculate. And so I'm tempted to, you know, start riffing off of this. But I'm also wary of doing so, because I do have theories. And my theories do tend to deconstruct most of the other theories out there. But, you know, I'm not that an original. There's no such thing as a truly original thinker, probably, at least not if they're using their minds. So, you know, I could end up just being another mouthpiece for the latest second matrix, you know, wing of belief around this. But having said all that, with the disclaimer, one of my go-tos here as just a what if is, you know, what if it is all us? And what if what we think of as Satan, to just cut right to the chase, is an egregore or a tulpa, you know, or a collective thought form that's been generated over the millennia by the congregation in some sphere that we don't fully identify as real. It's physical, but it's subtler. Of all of our neuroses, you know, our ancestral hang-ups. What if they all just cluster together, and what little remnant of sentience those life husks have after we die amasses over time into some much larger, apparently sentient force that we then call Satan. And I just say, you know, what if? At least that's a kind of explanation as compared to Christians, who don't even bother, really, unless you go into Lucifer, the fallen angel, which isn't in the Bible. And of course, I do speculate on that too. And then it raises the question, well, we're back at that question. How and why did God create a beautiful angel that would go off and sulk and become the embodiment of evil? It has to be part of the plan, right? Everything has to be part of the God's plan. Even a Christian will admit that. So I don't really know if we get anywhere with those sort of speculations. But on the other hand, this is where liminality comes in. It's like there is this huge area between Richard Dawkins dismissing it all as mumbo jumbo and your hardcore Christian who just takes it all on faith, even though it's all logically inconsistent and simply doesn't add up and doesn't actually generally lead to a very healthy outlook any more than Richard Dawkins does. There's this huge spectrum in between, which I would say is just about how much are we willing and able to see about the nature of evil, in quotes, as in what human beings can do to each other, are doing to each other, and have done to each other over the millennia. And I mean, what would that look like if we really were able to fully see the implications of it, including possibly non-human or not, you know? Probably the word evil does become necessary at that point. I don't actually know. You know, for a lot of people, evil becomes necessary when you talk about the organized abuse and, you know, groups of individuals who are systematically raping and murdering children, which I often mention on the podcast. I wonder if I should. And one of the reasons I mention it is because it seems to me that it is happening. And so ignoring it or pretending it isn't and not talking about it seems like that seems sort of irresponsible. But if you do talk about it, it tends to be that people in their minds, they just go straight to those evil bastards, they should be destroyed. Or that's just too horrible, I can't think about it. Or a combination of both. So there is a natural tendency in us to flinch from evil, which is ironic because I postulated recently that evil came into being as a kind of original flinch mechanism, an original coping mechanism for not being able to deal with reality. As soon as we started to dissociate into these fantasy realms, we began to lose our capacity for empathy, and then that made it possible to abuse others as a way to relieve our own distress. And I think that is the nature of evil, actually, in a nutshell. And I don't know, that sounds like a very human thing to me. I can't really imagine a traumatized angel, really, although I've tried to, and I have partially succeeded, but if I'm honest, it doesn't really make sense to me. I think of Lucifer as being traumatized because God rejected him, like Cain, and so he went off in a huff and got up to all kinds of mischief to get Daddy's attention. It just seems like a human model, doesn't it? So my sense, without being a Dawkinsite, is that religions are very much crucial fictions for dealing with trauma, that at the same time they do correspond with metaphysical reality. It's just that they've got this traumatic overlay. It's back come full circle again, haven't we, to these narratives, that they have a profound transmission that the narratives are carrying, but there's this element of trauma in them that makes them both seductive and deceptive.
Yeah, when you talk about religions, I go back to what I mentioned with Rorty, is that religious discourse is a vocabulary. And sure, there's been several scholars over the years who've talked about religious truth. What does that mean? Usually it's revelation. You know, there is a God. God has revealed the truth behind the curtain, so to speak. And so one has to have faith to accept it. Or one can devise some kind of a logical underpinning of why this revelation should be taken as true, versus truth is something that one discovers through language, or truth is a quality of language that in speaking and writing and communicating, the truth emerges, sort of. And in the case of evil, I tend to lean more towards that it might be a human thing. I like the term egregore. I'd never heard of that before until the past couple of years. Just this, I can't remember the exact definition of egregore. It's just it's a projection.
I don't know what the exact definition, but I see it as like an aggregate of psychic energy from individuals and groups.
Right, an aggregate of psychic energy. And I kind of like that term. And what people have talked about with like an original wound or something like that. I don't know if you're aware of Morris Berman, who's an American commentator. Have you ever read his book, A Wandering God?
Oh, I have that book, but I haven't read it.
Yeah, I skimmed through it the other day because I had it for a while, and he's definitely in the category of how we came to where we are in society was a collection of decisions over millennia. But it originated with the fact is that if we were hunter-gatherers, or we were nomads first, then we became hunter-gatherers. So as nomads, moving from place to place, not sitting in one spot for very long, that's more in tune with our nature and reality versus if we are stuck somewhere, we're sedentary, and then we start building hierarchies and we're crafting all kinds of narratives and stories to explain something that is out, that is exterior to us, othering and all those things. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I didn't read through it in depth, and he deploys some Freudian concepts. Melanie Klein, he mentions too about transitional objects for children as the it's the go-between oneself as the child, as the individual, and reality. So there's not a direct encounter there. There's something else that takes its place, like a stuffed animal.
Right.
And using that as training, you know, you're talking to your toy, you're talking to your stuffed tiger versus imaginary friends, or even imaginary friends, is because you're not in touch with reality as we once were, how we evolved to be. So I think he talks about evil there. He certainly mentions like the Cathars, the Albigensians, and the crusade that happened there. Christian mentioning. So yeah, it's there are just some things I remember, and as I skimmed through it, I didn't read it in depth, and I think I should because I like Morris Berman. He's talked a lot over the years about the decline of the American Empire and also Coming to Our Senses is another book. Just these things about speculating what it once was millennia ago when we were nomads versus being sedentary. And that seems to be a source of a lot of our problems in society.
Yeah, I like Berman too. I haven't managed to get him on the podcast. I was thinking that the transitional object, I mean, you were hinting at without saying it outright that, let's say, a transitional object might also be a concept. I'm interested if this could relate to why the Jews said you shouldn't make images of God, because that would turn God into an object. I don't know if there was anything in that, but certainly I think for most people, religion, even if there isn't, well, of course there is for Christians now, there's an image of Christ, and Christ is supposedly God. So Christianity has gone against that first injunction of the Jews, don't make graven images, and they're very graven images. But anyway, I was wondering when you were speaking there if God as a concept and as an image, let's say, a kind of unimaginable image, is a transitional object for us to interface with reality, that is a sort of mirror of our identity. Well, let's say a mirror of our soul, perhaps, because it's divine and benign, whereas the identity isn't. But still somewhat, I mean, obviously very limited and limiting, because it's an image, it's an object, and even the idea of a soul is limiting, because it reifies this idea of us as individuals. And if there's anything in that, if Satan then is a transitional object for our relationship to the world as opposed to existence, see what I mean? Existence would be nature, but even, you know, beyond nature, like this, the whole of existence, which does include this eternal, the eternal, let's say. Satan may be a transitional object for us, could even be nature, actually, for us and temporal existence, let's say. And so then we get stuck, like children that can't let go of their stuffed animals. We get stuck with the transitional object as our mirror, really, in our way that we mediate reality, and then we think this is reality. And so then on the one hand we're in opposition, fear of renunciation of Satan, if we're Christians the whole time, our whole lives we have to do it every day, every minute, I renounce you, and the worship of God, which I always felt was somehow, well, I even used to say it was satanic, actually, to worship God, because it reinforced the idea of separation, which is what Satanism is to separate ourselves from God. So there's something even in worshipping God that somehow seems like a buffer that protects us from the reality that God is us.
Yeah, that's a tough one to wrap your mind around, because I haven't been to church in many years. You know, I wouldn't consider myself an atheist, I'm an agnostic. And to some extent, because I've been so immersed in philosophy for a long time, I'm kind of a practical atheist. It's just not something I think about when you're investigating things like epistemology or metaphysics even, and ontology, things like that. And there's a lot of secularists that come out of that, but they still seem to have a religious impulse. And being careful of subconsciously putting a transitional object in place, because we do not have a direct experience with reality. But then what does that look like? You know, that's more the $64,000 question. And what comes to mind whenever I pose that question is what the Zen masters talk about, you know, which I also thought was interesting when you talk about Devoshana and enlightenment is, well, yeah, I remember reading about enlightenment in Buddhism and Zen, where they don't particularly want to talk about it. It's not something you can put into words, particularly with transmission. You know, that's something recently too is, what does transmission look like? Is transmission in a ceremony? Is there a transitional object that the master gives the disciple to pass on the lineage, the Dharma lineage? And those are all questions that dance into my mind, and I don't have answers for them, course, I'm also the kind of person that likes to look at them as curios, you know, turning them around and looking at them in the light and seeing how they shimmer. That's just the way my mind works. It's playing with objects, playing with ideas that I don't necessarily take seriously. Mm-hmm. I don't think everybody can do that well.
Play with ideas.
Yeah.
Well, like I felt about the irony, and we never really got to whether I was understanding you correctly or not there, but or ironism. I would say that playing with ideas, and I'm not sure about you personally, because my impression of you is you are very light, seem to be light of foot and of thought and of, even of heart. So it may be a positive thing for you, but generally speaking, I wouldn't have thought of being able to play with ideas as such a virtue. As it seems like it could be very masturbatory, and as I say, I'm not talking about you here, but just that the use of that phrase.
Yeah, there's always that danger.
Yeah, and as far as the specifics of transmission or enlightenment, once we've acknowledged, which Dave O'Shaughnessy certainly does, that the trap of naming the Tao and therefore getting further away from the Tao, there still remains the possibility that it's a placekeeper, as in there is something that we know that we have somehow lost a full body experience of, and that we are trying to get back to, and so to some extent we need some markers. So even though we may know, particularly if we've been around the block a few times, like it sounds like you have and I know I have, we know that 99 times out of 100, as I used to say, that the signs to Jerusalem lead to Babylon. So if it says this way enlightenment, turn 180 degrees and go the other way kind of thing, although that would be too oppositional, but just, you know, don't follow the sign just because it says enlightenment is a no-brainer, right? But then to then, as I say, leave that space to, well, if somebody had found this thing that I've been looking for my whole life and they did want to let others know, how would they do it? Well, they would have to use some word for it, and chances are the word would be one that I would recognize and therefore would think, that can't be true, right? There is no way around that conundrum at all. So then it comes down to really checking closely the goods, doesn't it? So I've spent 12 years checking out O'Shaughnessy's goods. Well, I'd say the last few years I've stopped checking them out in a suspicious way or a consumer way, and I've just started consuming. I just contradicted myself, but you know, I came off the fence and just thought, well, let's actually just start trying this out, fully committed to it, and see what happens. And what I think I've been discovering is that this is something that is inherent or innate within myself, not even as a potential, but as a lived reality that I haven't been noticing. And having somebody as this placekeeper, which is also a transitional object, having somebody who is noticing it, not only in themselves, but in me, is switching the emphasis slowly over time from the part of me that doesn't notice, my mind, to the part that does notice, which is my life force.
So it's a positive feedback loop.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not really language dependent, except that we're human beings, so we do talk, of course, so there is that. Like, I don't know how to get around that. It's just it doesn't necessarily have to be an obstacle, language. It's weird, it becomes an obstacle the more we think it's going to actually help us, the more of an obstacle it is, I suppose. The more we just say, well, it's not in the language, but we can let the language be there.
Right. Well, just briefly going back to what I was trying to import with what Rorty had to say about irony is the language is there and it's inescapable, really, because we use language to communicate, to express our thoughts from one person to another or to lots of different people over time in the case of writing. But don't take it as the truth, as the unerring truth, the true for all time. because that's where the contingency comes in. Aristotle and Plato, they wrote in Greek. They didn't write in English. And so what we read of them, if you don't read the Greek, you're reading English. So there's already some contingency there when they were writing. The ideas, there might be the meat of the ideas that are in there, but if you're reading them in translation, you're always going to lose something in translation, as the saying goes. But then if you also understand that when they were writing it at a certain time. You know, I've tried to impress this upon people that I've tutored from time to time over the years, that if you're reading somebody like Plato or Aristotle or Hume, you know, some from hundreds of years ago, don't try to impose your 20th century or 21st century eyes on these people. Remember that they were writing at a certain time, given the knowledge that they had at the time. So certainly technology wasn't like it is now. Certainly recording technology wasn't as like it is now, nor was writing on a screen versus writing on paper, some other contingencies. But the thing about the ironist is, according to Rorty, is that that person knows that what they're working with is contingent, and they don't take it as the unerring truth, true for all time. Make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, so that's different from what I was imagining, because of the word irony, because it has that modern that modern meaning, and it's so prevalent now, irony. Even the term ironic detachment, I don't know if I coined it, but I use that in Seen and Not
Seen. It's more of a classic sense of irony that's existed in literature from a long time ago.
So what would be a classic definition of irony?
Well, I mean, just understanding, you know, what I said about language, you're understanding that it's contingent. You can't escape from language you're using that, but you also know that I could be speaking German to you right now, depending on whatever my upbringing was. Or I might not have been educated enough, and I'm only speaking at a third grade level versus a college graduate.
Right. So, irony is a funny word, because it's one that everybody knows and everybody
but they can't
knows.
Articulate it.
Yeah, they can't define it. It's a very hard thing to define, irony, isn't it? And it today it has an association with an attitude. It has an association with sort of humor, with whimsy, even sarcasm. Like sarcasm and irony seem quite closely related, I would say.
Yeah.
But what you're talking about, I mean, I'm just trying to find out what's the connective tissue between that very sort of contextual definition of irony and the modern sense. And is it to do with that words can sometimes mean the opposite of what we think they mean?
They could, or the language is poor to describe what you're trying to do. You really can't find the word to explain what it is. Like you refer to the life force. Okay, I'm sure there's better terms that one can come up with that are not English terms, such as, you know, anima, the Latin phrase, or nous, the Greek term. Now we're getting somewhat philosophical here, which may or may not mean the same thing.
Yeah.
But you use term life force. And, you know, God is an excellent example, which is why, you know, for as much as I've read in philosophy, I tend to be very, very cautious whenever I use the word God, because I don't know how the other person is going to take it. Because are we talking about the Christian God, the Jewish God, something else, an abstract entity? What? It's hard to say. It's really hard to say.
Yeah. So there is a spectrum. I presume it's a continuum with not a clear dividing line between words that are very clear in their meaning and words that are not. So the one end of the spectrum we've got God, the other end of the spectrum we've got the shovel again, the spade that we're going to call a spade, right? And it begins with the spade, doesn't it? Because how big does the spade have to be to not be a trowel, right?
Right.
So I suppose it is inherent in everything, and we've chosen to call some things trees and some things bushes, right? Well, again, who's determined this? So it might seem as though language is cut and dried up to a point, we're into the metaphysical, we're into the subjective now. But it's probably more accurate to say that language is never cut and dried.
No, and you know, referring back to when people describe about trauma. So, you know, as you were saying about the story, is you you feel that something had happened in your past, but you can't corroborate it. There's really no way that you could do that because it was so long ago. But you accepted, I mean, the term that I wanted to mention earlier was the as if. You operate as if this were true. You operate as if this were the case. Even though you might not know, and this, I think this is where the irony comes in too, you know that it probably is not the case, but you accept that it is the case, or that you accept it is true.
Well, that would be a bit weird, that last thing. Like if I thought it was probably not the case that I was sexually abused, I would then proceed on the assumption as if it hadn't happened. It's only right. Because I think it probably did happen that I more or less have committed to it. I'll just live as if it happened. Or, I mean, it doesn't necessarily make much difference in how I live, actually. It's probably down to language again. You know, how do I talk about these things and how committed am I to them? And I think maybe in a certain sense, the part or a big part of the value of these questions that can't be answered, and ironically, this is something Strieber has said, is in learning to live in a state of ambiguity, actually. If one can settle into the acceptance of never knowing if something catastrophic happened to one in one's past, that's quite a high bar as far as surrendering, you know, to the impossibility of ever being certain about things. Theoretically, anyway. I mean, I'm not saying it's worked that way for me, but maybe it has. I mean, I think I have become less obsessive and less driven over the years, and partly that's because one of the things that was driving me, or the main thing, was to get to the bottom of the trauma, and I got close enough to the bottom to see that it was maybe bottomless. So a big part of it is that, but the other part is also that I have to relax and let go in the face of the unknown, which is existence, because it's staring me in my face constantly, right? Once you start to see where my own childhood is unknown to me, then who am I? It's like the question, who am I, is just, I guess it slowly replaces the voice that keeps telling me who I am. You see what I mean? Instead of me just constantly saying, I'm this, I'm that, I keep hearing, who am I? Who am I? Yeah. It seems to be progress.
Yeah. Well, just one more thing about language. Prose versus poetry. So you mentioned that you've written song lyrics before, and I'm sure you've written poetry. Did you ever find that poetry expressed things a lot better than writing a 600-page book?
No, I'm not a poet. I'd have to be a real poet for that. Yeah, I suppose there's been times where I've come up with what I called aphorisms for this newsletter that we did locally. I came up with a bunch of aphorisms, if I can even remember one now. The only one that's coming to mind is not particularly poetic, but is learn to discern the difference between those who are consciously leading and those who are simply moving forward visibly. Anyway, I wish I could have thought of one that was more poetic, because the good ones were more like Zen koans. But the idea was to condense some sort of wisdom. I suppose the thing I did for my niece as well, 18 things I wish somebody had told me when I was 18. I feel as though I got more into that with just a few words. I did write a book to accompany that video, but it was a very short book as well. In a certain sense, I felt as though that had more transmission. I put the quotes there because, like God, that word could mean different things for different people. So what do I mean by transmission? I just mean more of really what I have to deliver. In this case, what I had to deliver to my niece. I guess because it was my niece, but there was more of me in that, my essence, in those few lines, I think, than probably, or certainly than whole books that I've written, you know, if I include the books I wish I hadn't written. So I guess that would be incorporated under poetry then, but they're more like very condensed phrases that condense a whole bunch of life experience into a single platitude.
What do you think was the most important of the 18?
I was just thinking I was going to pull them up and then I could look at them, but I guess that would be cheating. I mean, they were, if it was easy to pick one, then there wouldn't have been 18, but the last one was you are your own best kept secret. So I guess in a certain sense that summed up all of them. I don't know. Most of them were more, they were more kind of advice based, like the only thing you have to do is in life is pay attention, is to show up and pay attention. You aren't your thoughts and feelings, although you might think you are. The body, it's where it's at. Sex is not as important as is not all that important. The things it took me a very long time to learn that I just thought would be helpful for somebody who was just starting out on that life path, you know.
Yeah, the other ones sound quite prosaic versus the first one.
Yeah, the first one that was the last one, that's right. Most of them are quite prosaic. And I felt they built towards that final one, which is, we actually don't even know what we are.
Yeah.
Question for you, which is when you mentioned Jay Dyer and these guys and all these other guys, and it seems as though you're lumping me in with these guys, which I don't even know who the other guys are, but I'm curious about that. So it's like you have a certain go-to sort of group of voices that you refer to, and it was around the question of evil specifically, but I think it's also around Christianity. So who are they, and how do I fit in that collective?
Well, the common element is a collective organized evil. And the lead in, I mean, in Jay Dyer in particular, I don't think he dabbled in the occult, but he definitely was into movies. And the two books he wrote from a few years ago are Esoteric Hollywood.
Yeah.
Of the occult symbolism, all these things in movies such as like David Lynch and Steven Spielberg and Stanley Kubrick and so on. So he did a deep dive into those. And, that's where I saw the commonality between the two of you. Where the two of you diverged in particular is that he's very much into orthodoxy now, and he's done talks on orthodoxy, you know, close readings of the Bible, certain orthodox. I mean, he's read the church fathers like Tertullian and I can't remember their names, but he spent a lot of time over this and really is a deep dive in orthodoxy. Lots of stuff that I didn't know, you know, and I like to consider myself well-read, but not in the case of Christianity, particularly that's non-Catholic or philosophical, like Aquinas and Duns Scotus and people like that. And him going off in that direction, I think, is interesting, but at the same time, I'm not that particularly interested. But the question that pops into my mind is, what is it about orthodoxy? You know, I also have an answer to this, what they've kind of given. Is orthodoxy or Christianity is the best explanation for evil that the person has found, and this is not Jay necessarily. And orthodoxy is the best way to avoid dialectics because of transcendental argumentation. So you're not getting bogged down in disputes over what God, does God exist or not? What is God? How would you define God? And so on and so forth. Again, I profess ignorance in terms of orthodoxy because he's far more well-read than I am in that. And then this return to like orthodox, this return to Christianity rather, getting away from the secular run that has been the case for the past 15 to 20 years or so. So that's where I see some of the overlap. And I'm not, I wasn't necessarily lumping you into the same category. Definitely in Jay's case, because the two of you were into movies a lot and talking about esoteric symbolism.
And who are the others then in that that you refer to?
Vox Day is one who's been around for a long time. He's not Orthodox, but he's an evangelical non-denominational Christian.
Yeah.
Which I've encountered before, and so whenever somebody mentions that, then they start to talk about things like Jesus Christ is my Savior, I have accepted him as my Savior, the God of this world, Satan, you know, this is a fallen world, blah, blah, blah. And that's not to say that Catholicism and Orthodoxy don't say the same thing. But I do know that one specific difference between Catholicism and Orthodoxy is that Orthodoxy has a different take on original sin, that we don't have the mark of Adam from the Garden of Eden as the Catholics take it, or rather that the same failings that Adam had, we live with, being imperfect beings, created beings.
Right. So by and large, then, your interest in me and my work is consistent with your interest in other disseminators who are Christian.
Sort of. Again, not 100%. It's more the esoteric element. Right. Where, again, I'm not as well read as some people like yourself in the occult. I just nibbled at it over the years here and there. I'm not a scholar in it, but I kind of was drawn to that and somebody who uses that as a way to explain certain things that are off in the world, like abuse. And I kind of know about abuse because my partner, she's a social worker who works with sexually abused kids. Right. So that's the closest that I've come to somebody who has worked with sexual abuse. Now, she certainly doesn't talk about occult influences that might be there. It's more like, you know, there's sexual predators, be careful against sexual predators, but it's not an explanation about why somebody was a sexual predator. Okay. And you can come up with a clinical definition and explanation for that, but when somebody starts talking about the occult, I'm like, that's interesting. I never quite thought of it that way. Does all that make sense?
I mean, it sounds like you're mapping your world and your reality, starting a long time ago with philosophy, and now you're talking about social aspects and so a spectrum from the very mundane, such as what your partner works with, child sexual abuse, to the more concealed, which is the organized occult aspect of that, and then all the way to this the question of evil, I guess, and the Christian perspective on evil. That's the spectrum, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And the one final thing too, the last thing I wanted to talk about was about community. And this is in reference to your recent podcast with Jim Kunstler.
Yeah.
About, you know, the best business model that you've encountered is one that serves the community, which I kind of have thought about for the past few years, but also the difficulty of trying to find a community. And I guess for me, what it is the sense that I'm more aware of this now that I'm older than I was when I'm younger, is not wanting to spend a whole lot of time just poking about to see what the response is. Rather, I'm much more inclined to look at somebody who gets it, just gets it intuitively, versus trying to explain, because I don't have the interest and I really don't have the time to explain.
But is this about having a conversation about it, or is this about actually trying to do it?
Both. I mean, it's good to talk with people like yourself who might have felt the same things or have gone through the same experiences, but then how does one go about to do it too?
Yeah. Well, presumably if one was going to do it, well, not presumably actually, but it might involve talking to other people about it as well. I mean, we had a period where we were, after we started Thristle, where we did create a spin-off, which was the U Branch Collective, and we were trying to do these community projects, but none of them took off. I mean, we didn't get, except our newsletter, we got the newsletter going, and that's because my wife and I did it, just the two of us, so it really was no different than what we were already doing, except that we extended that into the community. I mean, that it didn't come about because the community cooperated with it and because we were able to create a collective. So then that just left the thrift store, which has continued to serve the community and be an effective model of community business. But it seems to me, you know, only because it just naturally evolved. You know, when we try to actually expand, not the business, but the idea of community projects, it was very, very difficult. Actually, so, and when you said that, how do you find your community? Well, I would say that I haven't found my community. Actually, this is my community because I live here, and now I run a business with my wife that serves my community. But I don't feel. It's not I don't feel I belong here, because obviously I'm here, so I do belong here in a certain sense. But I don't feel much affinity with the members of my community. There's very, very few, there's none actually, if I'm frank, that I would want to have over for dinner. I mean, not one in 6,000 people, right? Now, I am not a very social person, so I'd have to really like someone to have them over to dinner. There are people that I like, but by and large, they're not interested in what I'm doing online, and that's what, there's at least one person who is, and I did have her over to do a podcast. So maybe dinner isn't the right analogy. Maybe a podcast is a better analogy. But that's one out of 6,000 people in my community that I've actually done a podcast with, Janaya, because she was a victim of ritual abuse, was the reason there. So it was less to do with ordinary affinity and more with extraordinary affinity. So the net conclusion from that is that this hasn't been a way for me to find my community so much as to find a way to relate to a community, and that is totally dependent on the thrift store. I mean, I'm a different person in the thrift store. I have a function, and it is kind of like almost like Clark Kent and Superman, although I don't know which is which in this thing. But you know, it's just such a different mode of being, and I need both. I think the thrift store is more like Clark Kent, and my online thing is more like Superman, obviously, because it's very mundane, nitty gritty in the thrift store, and I feel I need it to keep me grounded and humble and so on. But to get maybe more to the point, maybe that I sense that what we discovered and developed with the business model of the thrift store could be extended to any number of other sorts of businesses. I mean, obviously it would be a limited number, because they would have to, by definition, be something that was useful to the community in a way that I think, anyway, that isn't just about what people want. I mean, obviously, people want cheap stuff, so they come to our thrift store, but they don't necessarily want the redistribution of wealth, or for clothes to be recycled rather than just thrown in the garbage, or, you know, or to relieve the pressure of all the creation of useless objects by redistributing those objects. I mean, that isn't something I necessarily felt strongly about, but it is something I feel good about being part of doing, particularly because it's not an ideological thing. I'm not an environmentalist by any means. I do hate plastic. We actually don't take kids' toys because I'm so offended by them. But so I do have some visceral things around there that are then pleasant visceral things as well. Like I get to feel like I'm cleaning up my environment on a daily basis. But that's kind of, I mean, that wasn't my motive. I didn't think, oh, I could run a thrift store and I feel like I was doing some good. I just discovered that second, you know, not secondhand, but peripherally. But the point I was making there was, I presume that for a business to serve the community, it would have to be serving what I call the invisible community as well, which would include nature and even the nature spirits, if we want to get fanciful, and, you know, the whole continuum of consciousness that is this planet, that somehow was in line with that, or at least not disrupting it. It seems to me that's something we just lucked into, and it would be, I don't know how hard it would be to figure out, you know, what kind of things really do reduce the toxicity of the environment, or at least don't add to it. I don't know how many there are. I mean, I honestly think the thrift store is an amazing model. I think anyone who could just do that, I'd say just do that, because it's just so basic. But presumably there are others, and I haven't thought of them. I mean, maybe we could think of some together, because certainly it's what some people need and want and are looking for, isn't it? It's a sustainable form of income that serves the community and that allows for the gradual establishment of a post-economic collapse, or, you know, a world made by hand.
Well, the model that came to mind when you mentioned the thrift store, or the model that works in the community, was a bar, a neighborhood bar. And I'm thinking in particular of a girl that I went to high school with years ago. I was checking up on her, as I do periodically with my old high school chums, and I noticed that her father had died. This was a couple of years ago. And he ran a local bar for something like 40 years. And what popped into my mind was, well, he probably was an integral part of that community. He was born there. He grew up there. He started the bar. Maybe he had partners, maybe not. He earned enough from years ago to send his daughters to private school where I attended, then maybe to college. And he continued to run it until he couldn't. And maybe his sons, if he had sons, took it over, or maybe he sold it or something else. But for those 40 odd some years, he was definitely an integral part of the community. And then I think about, you know, Cheers, place you go where everybody knows your name. Mm-hmm. You know? A place where you have a drink, but it's not just to have a drink. You go chat with Sam Malone and the other barflies that are there, and it's how information is disseminated, or you just go after a hard day. It's because you don't want to go home to listen to your bitchy wife. You'd rather just talk to the bartender.
Well, the problem with the bar, well, because there's a new problem now, which is that they'll probably be outlawed, but the other problem with the bar, and I mean, I'm a bit biased because I don't like alcohol, and I don't like people who drink much, but, or alcoholics, but the problem is, I think, endemic now, is that many people who go to bars are going to get drunk. So there is something fundamentally toxic about a bar. I mean, alcohol itself, I'm not saying it has to be. Of course, one can just have one drink and a very merry occasion. But so many people go to bars now, as you said, to escape the bitchy wife, or to escape their mundane lives, and so then it becomes, it's not really about community. That's my feeling, but course that would depend on how healthy your community was, but I would say in the average community it might be quite hard for a bar to really be a healthy environment. I just say maybe a cafe would be closer, because at least then people aren't going to to drown their sorrows.
Yeah, I could have said cafe too, and I think I agree with you. I think that's a better model, because I've been in enough bars in my time, high class ones and dive bars, that I don't. The high class bars, I'm like, I don't drink. I mean, I do drink, but it's like beer or wine. I don't go into to sample scotch, expensive scotch or cigar bars or anything. They just don't hold no appeal to me. And the dive bars are just depressing and pathetic.
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe the thrift store is the better option going forward.
Well, I certainly think it's better than a bar, and maybe a cafe, although of course depends what a community needs, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. But the thing with the thrift store as well is that I think it has untapped potential, as in, I suppose a cafe does too. I mean, we're talking about anything really. If it creates the right context, that people start gathering there, things happen that you wouldn't expect to happen. So certainly that could be true of a cafe. But it was, for me anyway, there was something about the thrift store that I've tried to communicate, because when I talk about it, that's why I talk about it so much, that it's actually a template for how to live and work together, that somehow it's just kind of naturally popped up. It's been co-opted and corrupted, actually, in Britain at least, because they're all charity stores now. They're all run by these public charities that are skimming the profits, and God knows what else they're doing, but NGOs and what have you there.
Yeah, well, same thing here in the States. You have the Goodwill, which is a large organization, the Salvation Army, which is a large organization. Local ones you don't have. I don't think I've seen that.
Right. So it might be quite subversive to reintroduce that. I don't know. But I mean, yeah, I can't. Obviously, I've got nothing to compare to. I'm sure there are other models, and there's probably quite a few. But what's surprising and satisfying about my experience with the thrift store as a model is that it has revealed something that I didn't know was there, which is there's a way for members of a community to meet and interact and exchange in different ways, more than just one thing, not just goods, but time and energy and what have you, that transforms lives, or at least changes them anyway.
Yeah.
So that was unexpected. I mean, if somebody had said that before, I'd say, what do you mean? It's just a thrift store. One has to experience that. And maybe it's unique, maybe it's just a one-off, and maybe the point isn't about a thrift store, maybe it's not even about business that serves the community, but finding what our life force is trying to do, and doing it. Maybe it's just about that, and that, I always used to say, well, bees make honey, what do humans make? Like, what is it we're actually here to make? How do we enhance our environment instead of destroy it? I don't think we've really hit upon that. And maybe we never will as a model, because it wouldn't work then. Like, bees don't read the manual on how to be bees, do they? It's innate. So we've lost touch with our instincts. And for me, the thrift store has been very much about rediscovering my instinct. And a big part of that is compassion for the other being part of a community, and all of that's quite foreign to me. It's not part of my conditioning and my upbringing. But I think probably the net gain isn't having a place in the community, but rediscovering my instinctive, intuitive sense of how to relate to my environment.
And to the others in the environment.
Yeah, yeah. And how to work together. It's a kind of a cheesy phrase, but it is what it is, and I mean that is what it is, and that does describe it. And it's not at all sentimental, because working together at this level, very beginner's level, really means holding a space for really difficult, sometimes impossible people with their demands. that's where working together begins, you know, because there's plenty of NGOs and stuff and environmental movements. There are people, they say they're working together, but they're not even scratching the surface of their neuroses, whereas somehow we created a space in the thrift store where people can come in with their full neuroses, and obviously they don't just vomit on the counter, although that could happen. But I mean, it is pretty raw there. We don't have many measures or controls, and there's nobody we ban. Even shoplifters we let shoplift, because what else can we do, right? So that is fairly unusual. But it does. I think that's. It's like clearing the table, isn't it, or creating a foundation. I don't think any institution or organization that thinks it's working together really is, if it hasn't first cleared out all of that neurotic gunk of just human beings having to accept each other as they are. That rarely happens.
Yeah, and that's something that I wasn't quite aware of when I was younger, because I've never really put a whole lot of effort into trying to start a business, just because of one, lack of interest, but two, also what you just voiced, is over time you begin to notice the dysfunction and the neuroses of the people that you're working with, even if it's only minor or slightly inoffensive, or that they just don't have enough skin in the game or the time to actually make the thing work. You know, if you're talking about young guys and all they have is time and they live together in some dive flat somewhere in a big city trying to create the next app so they can be bought by Google, that's one thing. But then if they start dating and then they start pairing off, get married, have kids, and then they go get a corporate job or whatever it is, then it's pretty much like a band too. It just falls apart eventually if they don't put the energy into it.
Yeah, and when we're talking about neuroses, I mean, we say that's a relatively deep thing as compared to just trying to work together and be successful. But what's underneath the neuroses, you know, we're getting into this trauma load that we're all carrying around collectively and individually, and then we're getting into the question of evil again, which is that people are possessed by their trauma and by their coping mechanisms that do involve abusive behaviors and manipulative behaviors. And that, you know, in a, I would say, Girardian sense, that there's a demonic element to that. Like, people are, whatever we think of as people, socialized beings, are inherently destructive. I'm afraid I have to put it that way. I mean, and that's me kind of trying to soft pedal it. We're so dysfunctional that we have a kind of malevolence to us, I think, and that, so that's never factored in, really, unless we're scapegoating, and then of course it's front and center, and so then we have the world that we have, essentially, which is, you know, we see that the world itself appears malevolent, but we think that human beings aren't, except for a few over there. Well, no, it's got to be in all of us, because we're all sustaining the same planetary system.
That's where I like the term egregore. That's the best explanation.
Yeah, although it's that was the thing I didn't get to, is about these transitional objects, because they don't just protect us from the existence, they also protect us from recognizing it's us, don't they? So, both of them. I mean, like, the idea that we might actually be an instrument of God or an extension of what some people call God, whatever, that's terrifying in one way, but also, of course, that we might be an instrument of Satan, you know, that we might be possessed by this egregore, because that's what an egregore would be, wouldn't it? It's out there, but it's also in here, in us.
Yeah. Well, I never really had the fear of being possessed.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That's, I mean, when I look at myself, and I take to heart what you've always said about every one of us has suffered some kind of trauma, but some more than others. And I don't necessarily want to put myself in the category of somebody who is better than others, but maybe better than certain others. You know, never was sexually abused that I'm aware of, never was physically or mentally abused that I was aware of. But certainly have experienced some traumas in my life, just from other people who were not really malevolent. They were just maybe acting out their traumas, or they were control freaks, things like that. You know, just lower level type stuff.
Sure. It's hard to imagine many or even any humans out there who are consciously malevolent. I mean, I can imagine it, but it is hard. So certainly I think that 90% are unconscious. As you say, they're just acting out their traumas. But I also think that that extends to all of us in different degrees. And the thing about being possessed is that we wouldn't know it if we were. And of course, that's true of trauma too, isn't it? Severe trauma, we don't know it. And so I think it's generally a mistake. I mean, at least you said that you're aware of, because people, when people say I was never sexually abused as a child and they don't add the qualifier, then I know that they're not willing to really think about it, right? But,
Well, that comes with age. You know, if you'd asked me at 10 years old, were you ever sexually abused? I probably would not have had the language to describe that. Hell, it wasn't until some years later when I started to process that a good number of my peers, similar age peers, had been divorced. No, my parents never divorced. They were together until my father died 4 years ago, and that's rare anymore. I never went through that trauma.
Yeah, well, I was going to say is I think it's probably the wrong context looking outside at others, because I think that whatever has traumatized us and uncoupled us from our life force, it's going to be, you know, very particular to us, and by its very nature it's going to be very hard to see and identify, and it's going to be to some degree or another crippling. So the comparison, I think, that's useful isn't between other people and ourselves, but between ourselves as we are and what we might have been or what we might still be. And I think there's very few cases there where that's not going to be quite shocking if we really start to see whether it's remorse or grief or regret or rage or, you know, I think for most of us there's no way to avoid a period of, and I'm not saying you haven't been through this, maybe you have, but of recalibrating, you know, our sense of who we are with what is actually true, and of allowing those feelings that we haven't allowed into awareness. And I think by definition that's always going to be quite shocking and quite overwhelming at some point or another.
Yeah.
Right? And so just to finish, I mean, the thing about possession, it's not so much, you know, what we're possessed by, whether it, you know, is it truly demonic compared to this or that person, but just any interjection at all in our system is potentially really an awful thing to have to deal with. And I think we are all dealing with that. We've all been colonized by a culture that is destructive.
Yeah, on that point, I definitely would agree. I didn't used to think about that when I was younger, because, you know, you don't know any better. This is the culture that you're in. And you do what you can to move through it, first survive and then try to thrive. But then once you reach our age and you start looking back and you're thinking, well, yeah, if the culture were different, we probably would not have the problems we would. It is an unhealthy culture. I don't have any bones about saying that. It is an unhealthy culture.
Are we the same age then?
I'm a little younger than you are.
51?
No, I'm 48.
48, okay. Somebody recently was 51, so I was wondering if it was you. Yeah, I got a few years on you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's all I wanted to talk about. Should we end with your one aphorism, your best kept secret?
Did we cover everything then?
Yeah, that's it. I wanted to keep it an open-ended conversation. I'm satisfied with it.
Me too. It was fun. I got the sense, right, to begin with, but I'm not sure now, that you wanted to ask about writing because you yourself were either trying to write or trying to decide whether you wanted to write or not. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that was another question too. It was a minor question that, you know, I can write, but I always remember something that a professor of mine told me many years ago, where he said, write when you have something to say.
Yeah.
It sounds quite prosaic, but I also take it as profound. So sometimes that's been a retardation of trying to express something. And I was talking with somebody last night because I was kicking around the idea of becoming a content creator myself. And there are times when you have to hear it from somebody where they say, yeah, you have a message to deliver, and so I recommend you do it.
Right.
Did you just can't. You just, yeah, they said that. And sometimes I found it hard to give myself permission to do that.
Right. Well, you've started by doing this podcast. I don't know about started, but this would be a step in that direction, because you will soon be on the record for the whole egregore to hear you.
That's right. They know where I'm at.
Yeah, so you could ask the egregore to give you its opinion.
Yeah.
I would probably go on stronger than your professor and say, only write if you can't stop yourself from writing. But that might be maybe too high a bar. I don't know. But certainly, I would think that it would be optimal to really feel like an overwhelming desire to do it.
Yeah, I've heard people that are like that. They just are compelled to write.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe I'm just being too subjective there, because that's I've tried to stop and I've failed. So,
right.
So I'm lucky or unlucky depending on how you want to frame it.
I've never described myself as somebody that's possessed to just get a message out there. Rather, yeah. I'm more of a tactician, for lack of a better term, which is I can take in a lot of information and sift through it and then operate on that, but really within the context of something else. That's where I seem to shine.
Right.
So whatever I put out there is not because of a compulsion. It's because of an interest that, okay, well, I can contribute something to this, and I do so. Do I want to continue with it, run with it, and constantly push out content? No, because I would probably balk at that, thinking that it's a job where it's no longer fun or it's no longer interesting. And I'm not saying that has to be the only criteria of which one has to write. Certainly, I'd say that the chief criteria is that somebody has something to say and they just have an overwhelming urge to get it out there.
In a good way, because of course some people are compelled, and it'd be better if they'd resisted, and then some people do feel a strong urge and they suppress it. So it's obviously a spectrum, but certainly I think we are here to share and to deliver something. So I guess that's the same thing your professor said. Really, I just rephrase it. If you have something to deliver, then better go ahead and deliver it, because time is running out.
Yeah, and I also remember that he probably said that within the context of being an academic.
Yeah, right.
Because I tried to be an academic many years ago, and I just couldn't do it because I did not like, among other things, the politics, but also because I didn't want to have to continually write articles that nobody was going to read and I had no interest in writing, just to put it out there.
Yeah, that sounds terrible.
Yeah, it's that truly would have been hell.
There ends that conversation with Tim Kay. Next week's podcast will be a return to dialoguing with the one and only Gib Strange. The 16 Maps of Hell campaign has now reached and surpassed its second goal of £6,660. We're now just over £7,000. What I'm aiming for now is £8,880 to cover the costs, more or less, of a hardback edition. These editions, paperback and hardback, are Smythe sewn. This is the main reason for the high costs of these books, which I'm sure some of you have noticed. There will only be 200 paperbacks in Smythe sewn. This is my plan anyway. And if there are any, only 50 hardbacks, Smythe sewn. Any extra funds that I raise, and probably even the profits that I make, I will put into a second run of Perfect Bound 16 Maps of Hell for the Stragglers, which may or may not be available simultaneously. You'll see as things proceed, but those copies will be somewhat inferior in terms of quality and durability, just so you know. There are currently 60 copies. There aren't any copies, of course, but if there is a 200 run of Smythe bound copies, 140 of those are already spoken for, so that means there will be 60 more available, or there are. So get it while you still can, or be an also ran. That also applies to whether your name ends up in the Book of Hell or not, because I'm only going to include the first 200 contributors, and we're up to somewhere around 155 contributors so far. So hurry to your mouse and click away, and thank you very much everyone who has supported this and made this campaign such a rip-snorting success so far. Yeah.